Claire, and you're listening to the Mother Love Podcast, a show where we talk about the journey of parenting. This is a space where guests open their hearts, gather their courage, and tell the truth about what it means to care for these messy and delightful little ones in today's big, wide, and often overwhelming world. We talk about the pressures, the steep learning curves, and the bittersweet reality of watching our children grow. Parenting asks us to be willing to feel it all, celebration and grief, joy and anguish, fear and courage. So take a breath, let these stories wash over you, and show yourself a little love. Hi, Mother Love listeners. I am here today to kick off our series of interviews that we are doing for National Native American Heritage Month. And I'm just thrilled to be here with my buddy, Dr. Amy Stefarm, as well as Dr. Janelle Palacios. And we're just going to start with introductions and kind of so that everyone can understand who's on today. So, Amy, hi.
Hey.
I'm so happy that you're doing this with me today. We're both fans of Dr. Palacios' work, and so this is going to be really fun. I'm excited.
Yes, and I'm a big fan of the Mother Love podcast, so I get to be a co-host. So I need like a hat, or I need this to be a little more official, but I'm very excited.
We have hats. I can get you one.
Okay,
they're pink though, and I just don't know if I see you wearing a pink baseball cap, but maybe.
Well, I'll do it for the gram. Just kidding.
Anything for the gram.
Yeah.
Yay. And then good morning, Dr. Janelle Palacios. Thank you for being here with us today.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Will you just start by kind of introducing yourself and talking about all of the current different roles that you play with your work today?
Sure. I am actually from Montana. I'm a Montana native, although I live in Northern California right now. But I grew up on the Flathead Indian Reservation, and I am Salish and Kootenai. My family, most of my family still lives on the reservation throughout the reservation. I grew up all over the reservation. So I lived in Ronan and Pablo and Polson and attended all the public schools there. And my mother moved us off when I was about 16. And I finished high school in Washington State. I later went on to college at the University of Washington and became a nurse. And soon after that, I then enrolled in graduate school in California and became a nurse midwife. And I also received my PhD in nursing. So I did research and I did clinical work. And on the research side, I was able to work with the tribal community on understanding what teen pregnancy experiences were like for women, Native women who'd been teen mothers. And on the clinical side, I worked in Northern California as a nurse midwife in a hospital. And most recently, I've been a nurse midwife for about 12 years or so. And I also have just taken an associate research position, professor position at Montana State University. So, you know, the grizz in me and the bobcat in me, you know, they kind of go face to face sometime, but the bobcat won out in this moment. And I've been very blessed to be invited to be an associate research professor and do work with the School of Nursing and colleagues at MSU on perinatal health. I also recently completed a 4.5 year position as a committee member to a national advisory committee for the Department of Health and Human Services, where I and 7 other committee members who are recognized experts in our field of maternal infant health, we advise the Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services on how to improve maternal and infant health in our nation. So those are kind of like the big roles that I have had, some research, some policy work, and some clinical work for sure.
Wow. Yeah,
I know. Wow.
I just want to say, like, Montana, we're so lucky that you're doing work here and, you know, coming back, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And it's okay that it's at MSU. I'll allow it. Well, it'll be fine.
I tease my husband that I'm slowly trying to make our way back to Montana. I have to do Northern California, and I might have to hit the Northwest before we go to Montana. But eventually Montana, making it back to Montana is the goal.
Yes. Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing all of that. I'm curious, in your work as a nurse midwife, like, what are your favorite parts of that job?
Yeah. So it's expanded, you know, it hasn't narrowed down. It's more expanded. So where I work currently in Oakland, California, at a large hospital, I teach resident OBGYNs how to have the heart of a midwife and approach labor and birth and pregnancy and see it as a normal experience and recognize that nature is very powerful and intelligent. So I have that role and I love that. I love being able to work with these OBGYN residents and help them see that our bodies are smart and know what to do, and that we have to be very thoughtful about when we do interventions, how it can just complicate the picture. So I love advocating for normal pregnancy, physiological birth, trusting our bodies, but I also help them see when problems arise and complexities happen that, you know, different interventions and resources are needed. So I'm trying to help impart the art part of it. And a lot of it is sitting down and being by someone's side. You know, that is just a lost art that rarely happens, especially in fast-paced hospitals that are delivering, you know, like my hospital on a typical shift that's 12 hours, I might be a part of like between 2 to 5 births in 12 hours. So it can, that person-to-person connection can get lost. Sometimes it can, you miss out on that wonderful experience. So I like trying to role model that and coax that into them. So when we have someone who has a really long induction and talking about shared decision making and what does she want, or their partners and their family want, versus someone who's having their second or third baby who comes rolling in and is having a very fast, rapid birth and it wasn't what they expected, and helping them reach calm and peace so that they can try to help and have their baby in a nonviolent way. You know, like, I love being able to help show and demonstrate and coax that into the people that I'm teaching with. So it's very rewarding to do this work.
Wow. Yeah, I hear so many stories of mm-hmm. women and mothers who, and I myself included, wish that I had, my practitioners had had that perspective and that training. That's so incredible. Yay. Thank you for doing that work.
Yeah. And I just knowing like your work and knowing like how strong you've been in the advocacy and policy and research, like, you know, nerding out on your work and citing you and all your work with storytelling. And sometimes I like have to remind myself of like, and she's a midwife too. Like, you're catching babies while you're doing all of this, and knowing that you're teaching the up and coming OBGYNs, like, that just makes me so, so happy to know that they're able to learn from you like that. And I don't know, it's just like, you're amazing. So
thank you.
Yeah, same. I hope, Amy, that we can keep working hard in Montana so that those are realities that can happen with training, you know, new and practiced and long practicing providers here too. I don't think that's happening anywhere in Montana quite in that way. And when I think about your qualitative research, it must feel so satisfying to know and have heard so many stories about these particular needs, and then be able to step into a room and help address those. You know, I just, it's so wonderfully full circle and whole mm-hmm. work. Yeah.
No, it is. I was recently having a conversation with one of the OBGYN residents that I was working with, and we were talking about obstetrical violence. Like, is that really a thing? And I was like, yo, yes, it is a thing. It really is a thing. And we have to really be thoughtful about how we interact with people. And I gave several explanations of what that looks like in just everyday work that we do in the hospital. And I could really see that it was sinking in with her, that she was having aha moments, and it was, I could see that she was starting to like realize and feel sad for a role she may have played in enacting obstetrical violence. It wasn't her intention, but it's just how business is done, how birth is done in some situations without thinking about body autonomy and without thinking about experience of that childbearing process. So it is very powerful. And to be able to bring in research or bring in these stories into the work that I do, I hope helps impact the next generation of practitioners for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. That's wonderful. And so I love talking about that aspect too, because I do think it gives like listeners who maybe don't know about your work such a like a personal image of like what you do hands on in a room. And then we'll talk more about, you know, the other million zillion projects that you do research wise. But we wanted to go back to kind of the beginning of how you got involved in the work that you do. And so can you just take us way back to when you were a kid and kind of go through what happened that led you on this path?
Sure. Sure. No, my pleasure. It's only recently that I started telling like the real story, the root story. And the root story really comes back to having grown up on the reservation as Salish and Kootenai and living in a community that there are big differences in how people can be treated. I went to largely public schools that were dominated by non-Native people, and I experienced and I saw Native children being treated very differently than the non-Indian children. And it's small communities, you know, people know one another. And so I definitely growing up in a place that can have different experiences, whether it's discrimination or bias or racism, I definitely experienced that even living on a reservation. And I noticed that the women in my family did not have really great relationships with one another. And I, as a kid, I remember wanting to hug my mother, and she would become so stiff because she didn't know how to like hug really. So, you know, I had excellent relationships with my grandparents and my grandmother and my aunties, but I didn't have a good relationship with my mom. And I noticed that she didn't really have the best relationship with her mother. And then when I, as a teenager, talking to my grandmother, I learned she did not have a great relationship with her mother. And so behind all of this motivation was a real need to understand why there have been rips in these relationships that should be very strong and full of love and foundational for growth. And what were the barriers to that? Like just what was going on, what happened, and why can't we have these stronger relationships? And around the same time, as a teenager, a number of my friends became pregnant. I myself, my mother was a teen mother, her mother was a teen mother, and I'm sure my great-grandmother was a young mother. And in our day and age right now, that with different worldviews and different ways that life is lived today, you know, teen pregnancy is heavily scrutinized and is a negative bad girl thing. And I knew that my friends were not bad. I knew that they were having life experiences that very few opportunities existed for them, and whether or not they actually were choosing to have sex with someone, oftentimes they weren't, but they became pregnant. And now they were ostracized for becoming pregnant. And I was sometimes the person who went with them to their clinic appointment. And I remember going to an IHS clinic appointment with someone, and she was horrified. There was also known abuse about a provider that was going to be at this appointment. And we didn't say anything to each other, but we knew. And when she left her appointment, she was crying. So I knew then at that moment that I wanted to help her. I wanted to help women like her. And later on in high school, after I left the reservation and moved to Washington State, as a senior in high school, we had to come up with a job and learn about a job that we might be interested in. And I interviewed midwives and I spent time with midwives in Washington State. And that's what got me into midwifery. But, you know, to even get there, to even think of being able to go to college, like that was outside of, as a kid, outside of what I knew was possible. So, you know, my mother had barely graduated high school. Her mother had graduated high school. So no one had gone to college and it seemed like out of reach. But at one of the public schools that I went to while still on the reservation, while I was in middle school, a staff admin person who was Native, she asked me, she ran after me one day at lunch recess and asked me if I had good grades. And I said, yeah, I think I do. And she then said, you should apply and do this summer program for Indian students in North Dakota. And I did. And so for two summers in a row, I went to the University of North Dakota's InMed program, where they collected like 100 Native students that were in middle school to high school. And they exposed us to extra English, extra math, extra science. And then they also took us on tours to hospitals and they showed us nurses and doctors and dentists that looked like us that were from the tribes. And that was inspiring to see that.
Wow. I have so many like wow moments, because my first birth ever too was from my friend. She's my sister. We claim each other as sisters, but was her birth. And when she was a teen mom and when I was like a freshman, and I was scared, but she was not ever, you know, she would, like you said, she was not a bad girl or anything. Mm-hmm. She was and still is one of my most responsible friends. And yeah, just having you talk about that kind of just takes me back and mm-hmm. kind of reminds me of like, dang, that was my first experience with that. But also like InMed, you brought up InMed and that's Indians into medicine, right? Like mm-hmm. how many, I feel like I know so, I didn't do InMed, but I know like people in my graduating class in my PhD cohort went to InMed. And so like, how many people do you know that were at InMed that are like doing these like awesome things and this work and that you met there? Like, how is that? Are you seeing that occurrence too?
It's rare if I bump into someone who knows InMed through the middle school, high school program. A number of people went there during college, like college level. But I know two people from middle school that became, you know, one became a nurse, is I believe trying to become a midwife right now, where the, you know, contemporaries, and another person went into dietetics and nutrition, and all of us attended InMed, the three of us attended InMed, and we were all from Montana.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's awesome. I didn't come into this until like into this field or interested in birth until like way later. Right at the end of my undergrad. I just think it's so cool that you were interviewing midwives in high school. Like, can you kind of talk about that a little bit? Like it, yeah. Like, how did you come up with the idea for midwives? And yeah, talk about that.
Yeah, no, it was, I really have to give the high school that I went to like a lot of props, because it was just a really different experience from what I had experienced on the reservation in terms of like education. And in this high school in Washington, a lot of it was student led, you know, like they really wanted students to be interested in what they wanted to learn. And so when I knew that I wanted to interview midwives, I looked in the phone book. Who has a phone book today? The internets were just starting, you know, in the late 90s. And you had to get up really early if you wanted to download one page, because when California woke up, like you couldn't do it. So, you know, I looked in the phone book and I found like, I think three midwives' names. And at that time, I didn't know the difference. I just knew like the word midwife. And I didn't know that there were different kinds of midwives. Like there could be a nurse midwife, or there could be a lay midwife, right? Someone who learns by apprenticeship. And there could be home birth midwives. And The first person I met, she lived in the town that I lived in, and she was a nurse practitioner. So she was a nurse midwife. She did not do many births. She largely worked as a prenatal care specialist and a postpartum care specialist. But I was really interested in learning about like the birth part. And, but I interviewed her, and then I found a midwife that lived on Whidbey Island, which is, it was maybe like a 45-minute drive from where I lived. And when I went to her place, I was amazed. Now, having come from a beautiful place in Montana, it was hard for me to be satisfied when I would see other places outside of Montana be like, oh yeah, this doesn't compare to Montana. It's not as beautiful as Montana. So when I went to her place though on Whidbey Island, she had a birth center on an island that was completely surrounded by the forest. And she had basically these beautiful large wall windows that you could look out into the forest. And she had two rooms. One was, there were two birthing rooms, and they were completely comfortable and spacious. There was like a large king size bed. There was a big birth tub that was in this room. It was just a very peaceful, peaceful place. And my mind was blown, because up until then, you know, whether I was with a family member or a friend, healthcare looked different. You know, going to a sterile, uncomfortable office where you were unsure if the provider was going to be kind to you or let alone molest you in any way, versus birthing in a place that I kind of think back, my memories of like the hospital image I have of my memory is that it's like a trough, you know, like it was like birthing, like tables, gurneys lined up, and then just like curtains on rods, you know, as like a curtain, shower curtains on rods that were sectioning women off who were laboring. So like there was no private room. You could hear other people. Not a comfortable place, like not, in my opinion, not a really comfortable place to birth in. So when I saw this lady's birthplace, I was just stunned and thought radically, like, this is how birth is supposed to be. And how is it that I see that birth in this hospital view as normal? Like that is so not normal. This is normal. This is comfortable. This is where you have your family with you in that experience supporting you. So yeah, I kept that image with me going through school. And when it got hard, and it did get hard, it was what I was hoping to do one day. The care that I would be able to give, and the love, because there is love. You give love to strangers in this very personal experience that can really change their life.
Yes. I don't know, Claire, maybe we should be midwives. Like,
I'm into it. Let's go.
Thank you.
Yeah. No, it's so beautiful. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is so beautiful. And it's so like that last thing that you said about giving love during this time. It is such a powerful, small window of time that has an incredible impact on the trajectory of someone's life. And not just for the mother or the birthing parent, but like when I think about my own early days of mothering and how much, even just a little bit more of warmth and closeness and acknowledgement, you know, and validation, affirmation, what that would have done to that first month of motherhood for me. It would have been totally different, I think. And, you know, it's like for me, I was looking to find this new identity, and I was so unsure of it. And so, you know, just lacking so much confidence, that having someone build me up during that time would have been so, so helpful. So I love that way of thinking of it too, is like the people who are there with you are part of the environment and part of the, you know, the welcoming committee. And it's just such a,
yeah,
such an
important I was thinking that too, when you were talking
of time,
Janelle, about how empowering that sounds. And I mean, I had a midwife, I had a certified nurse midwife, and it just like these little things that I guess I never thought about in the context, but having you know, been to these bars, like, of my friends who were teen moms and some of my sister-in-laws. And it always just kind of felt like it was the OBs running the show. And I remember me and my family definitely, like, came into the birthing center. It was a standing alone birthing center with, like, that idea in mind, like the midwife was going to tell us what to do. And I remember at one point we even looked at her for something, or, you know, like, well, what do we do? Or what are, and she was like, oh no, like, this is all you, you know, I'm here to support you. And, like, she was literally, like, sitting most of the time, unless she was doing something for me. But she was like, oh no, I'm just here for when the baby's ready to come, like, whatever you need to do. And it was very much like, oh wow, like, she just kind of was like, it was so empowering of, like, this is your birth, it's not my job. And it was such a foundational shift. Like, me and my family were kind of, my family especially was, like, kind of shocked at first, like, kind of scared, like, what? But I also had a doula, so I was, like, very much, like, supported. But, you know, my family, we didn't give birth at our Indian Health Service for, like, a long time. Like, I was born out of the community. But my family, like, when I wanted to do a midwife, like, a standalone birthing center, they were pretty freaked out and they were all scared and people tried to talk me out of it. But yeah, it was hearing you talk about that, I'm kind of just remembering all of these, like, good pieces, you know? So thanks for sharing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I have a question, if it's okay to just go back a little bit to something that I'm curious about. When you speak about, Janelle, like, the impact that studying these relationships and kind of, like, you described it, I think you said, you used the word rip, like, in between the mom-daughter relationships in your family. I'm curious how learning about, like, turning that curiosity into motivation and then studying what you studied and learning what you learned the whole time that you've been, you know, officially, formally studying, it's kind of apparent how that has affected the work that you do with everything we just talked about, not only with the work that you do and have done supporting women during birth, but also now the wisdom that you're imparting on these upcoming providers and practitioners. On the other end of it, mm-hmm. I'm curious how it has impacted your relationship with your own mom and now your relationship as a mom with your children, because I know we talked about that before, yeah. that has been a healing process. Can you speak to that a little bit?
The healing part, you know, trying to understand the tears and the rips that happened in these relationships that should be strong. And when I was really trying to understand teen pregnancy, I realized that my lived experience accounts for knowledge, that what I have lived through accounts for knowledge that science is having a hard time sometimes explaining. So I learned in my literature review and trying to help, intentionally, I was trying to help providers understand, like, Native women's health in general, Native American women's health in general. And at the time, there was this new idea that what happens to someone from birth to death, from the moment they're born to the moment that they die, that there are things that can support our lives or take it away and be obstacles and cause stress. And this work at the time is called weathering. And Arlene Geronimus from Harvard had done this. She put forward some concepts about weathering, that for certain people, certain women, especially Black women, compared to white women, that Black women on a day-to-day basis are going to face things in their life that are going to affect them and cause more stress and affect their physiology, affect their body, affect their ability to carry a pregnancy, a healthy pregnancy, that may not affect other people. And so she was able to look at birth weight by Black women versus white women and look at what happens. She looked at twins. She also looked at twin mothers and looked at birth weights as well. So she was doing foundational work on that. And we now recognize this as it's been confirmed. You know, I have to say, like, you know, there's this knowledge that we know, and then we have to wait for like Western science to decide that it's like real. And so it was finally real through knowing that adverse childhood experiences, ACEs, so things that happen to you from birth to 18, can really affect your behavior, can affect your mental health, can affect your ability to find ways that are going to be healing for you. And whether that's escape through substances or smoking or drinking, or if that's going through therapy or whatever it is, but it has real impacts on your health. So we know that from birth to death, yes, from the lifespan, there are these things that can assault your life and accelerate poor health. Mm-hmm. And we now know that, you know, through ACEs or even epigenetics, that we know that after World War II, for example, as Nazi Germany was kind of compacting and closing in, the Dutch people were heavily impacted by Germans who were leaving the European countries. And basically, Germany troops were attributed to, like, basically getting rid of all the food and starving the Dutch people. And the people who were pregnant at the time and became pregnant after are called the Dutch famine cohort. So like they watched these women who were pregnant and became pregnant right after during this Dutch famine, what happened to their babies? You know, like what kind of birth outcomes did they have because they were starving? And then they also looked at the outcomes of the males and females that were born and looked at what happened to them later. And so there was this understanding and shift in science, like, oh my gosh, it really does matter. What happens to your great grandmother has impacted you already. You know, so this was just beginning, you know, in the early 2000s when I was doing this work. So I knew that there were these day-to-day experiences that are going to affect someone's health, but no one was really putting the piece in the maternal child world for helping us understand, well, what happens before birth, right? That intergenerational piece. So then I blended a historical trauma, which now is a big part of our vocabulary in the health sciences and in health in general for people, that historical atrocities, whether it is social atrocities that happened, or if it is like a hurricane or a volcano erupting, but something that's very, very traumatic that can disrupt a community, has impact intergenerationally. So putting these two together, what has happened to your ancestors and what happens to you today and throughout your life, that all of that can impact your health and impact your maternal and child infant outcomes. That was something that was very helpful for me to understand. It was something I had lived. And once I understood that, I was able to make the link that, wow, looking at the federal government's policies on Native American people, I can see how some of these policies, especially like forcing Native people from their ancestral lands onto smaller, isolated, geographically isolated reservations, which were done intentionally. The government said to keep the Natives, you know, free from settlers that were coming in, to keep them safe so that there would not be any skirmishes. But then again, like the government turned around, like on my reservation, turned around and sold excess land that had not gone to Native families, and then opened the doors for settlers to come in. So it was, you know, there was this hypocritical response, you know, a buck was to be made and a buck was made at the expense of Native people. But geographically isolating Native people, not allowing them access to their traditional foods. I grew up eating commodity foods. Mm. I grew up eating commodity foods. I grew up eating high fat, salty foods. And I remember in the 90s and early 2000s, all this research was done trying to understand why Native people were obese and had type 2 diabetes. And as a kid, I, you know, I'm thinking, look at the food that a lot of us were eating, right? But so understanding that access to ancestral land, ancestral foods, and then the government forced assimilation upon Native people. And we now have a federal report that was just released, you know, in the past year or two, that from Deb Haaland, Secretary Deb Calland on the Federal Boarding Indian Schools that it was intentionally done to break down the strong relationships, family and community relationships that Native communities had, because they had to break the Indian people. And they did that by taking children away. So my great-grandfather, Ernie Claremont, he attended Haskell Indian Industrial Boarding School. His wife, my great-grandmother, attended the day school, the residential day school on our reservation. So I can see that there, and we know at these boarding schools, the children were abused mentally, physically, sexually, psychologically, and they were not allowed to speak their language, to wear their cultural clothes, to practice their cultural beliefs and practices. And in the early 1800s, American Indian people were banned from their religion. So they couldn't even mourn and practice spirituality or practice their religion and honoring without the prospect of going to jail or prison. So, and it wasn't until 1978 that the American Indian Religious Freedom Act was passed. So about 100 years passed where Native people had to hide or just stop practicing the religion. So how do you make sense of all this? You know, and it didn't just happen to one generation of people, which is what we forget. We think, oh, one and done. It happened to these Native people. They're, it's done. It's gone. No, it continues today. You know, so the I see the tears and the need for healthy relationships intergenerationally among the women folk in my family, because there were so many actions and policies that deteriorated and eroded safety, that eroded parenting, that eroded self-identity, right? Mm-hmm. That eroded so much of people that really did probably affect how their mental health and what few options there were for coping with that. So violence became something that is, you know, that was done in school, in these boarding schools. And I'm sure that, and we even know from the Federal Indian Boarding School report that older children were encouraged to punish younger children. Mm-hmm. So I can imagine, and I have forgiveness. Mm-hmm. Right. That the women and the family members in my family, that they did not have the tools. They were hobbled. They were taken away. And then when they did not have the tools to be healthy in with themselves or with their parenting and their children, that there, of course, were going to be problems. So I have forgiveness understanding that. So understanding that what has happened intergenerationally and how it can manifest today, I am at peace knowing that even the things that happened in my childhood, that I forgive my mother, I forgive her grandmother, her mother, because we just didn't know, and they were trying the best that they could. Mm-hmm. And I think that healing. So for my mother and I, we and my sisters and I, we have talked about this, that we are doing the best that we can. And now that we understand these things going forward, we can have much better relationships. Mm-hmm. So that today manifests as I sometimes find myself having a hard time hugging my children. It just does not occur to me. I freeze sometimes when I see my daughter, you know, who's sharing something at school that happened. And I find myself like frozen in wanting to comfort her. And I have to remind myself, it's okay to touch her. It's okay to hug her. So I've talked to my kids, you know, my two older ones, about that I'm really working on being a different mother, of like expressing love without boundaries, right? Without any strings attached, without any intention tied to the outcome. I just want to be here to support them. And that has been very helpful through this process.
Mm. Wow. Gosh. And as you're talking, and I mean, cause I feel very similar about like, right, giving myself grace, giving my family grace, my ancestors grace for knowing somewhat of what had happened. And it's like, of course, this is happening. And even the physical health, you know, like you were talking about ACEs, like that impacts physical health too, like can lead to like heart disease. And when you were talking about like in the 2000s, 1990s, like ACEs and historical trauma, like finally getting talked about. And now in the research, right, it's like much more common. But like when we were kids and when our parents were kids, nobody was talking about it, right? Like nobody never had any of my parents even talked about boarding schools until all of this stuff started coming out in the media, like within the last 5 years. And I think that's something too. It's like, we have to go off to school usually to learn about these policies and these, everything that you were just talking about. It's not like we were growing up and being taught like, oh yeah, and this happened to your great grandma, you know, like for whatever reason, mostly pain and not knowing how to express feelings. Mm-hmm. That just wasn't talked about in our homes. And I think sometimes people don't understand that. Like they think that that's something taught to us as if it was our culture or, mm-hmm. you know, like how culture is taught to us or not taught to us because of assimilation and whatnot. But yeah, I think that's so important too, to think about like all of this was happening. We were being impacted, but nobody was talking about it at home or anything like that.
No, exactly. I say the same thing, that I had to leave the reservation to understand and learn our history. And now that I do have that understanding, I try to help other people understand that history matters, that definitely history matters. And it can be freeing, because what you're talking about, that grace and that peace and the forgiveness and all those things can really just enrich your life. You know, you can be healthier and your family could be healthier. Yeah.
Mm. Knowledge is power.
Right. Yes.
Well, speaking of knowledge and power, is like, can we talk? Is now like a good time to shift a little bit to talking about some of your research work? And, you know, storytelling has been a big part of your journey. And I'd like to just hear a little bit about that. Like, was that like what your graduate school work was on?
When you talk to people and you ask them questions and they tell their story, that's just fluff. That you need, you know, 1,000 upon 1,000 people to tell their stories in order to actually get the truth. Mm-hmm. So there's this shift, you know, philosophically of what truth is. So I often say that in a Western model, that numbers are have been inherited as like truth, the absolute truth and standard, but that there are many cultures that have used storytelling or qualitative research as as another source of truth, not just that one is better than the next, right? Mm-hmm. So it is that qualitative research or storytelling. And I believe like the title of my dissertation is Sharing Stories. It really was sitting down with women and asking them what was going on in their lives around the time that they became pregnant. So I interviewed adult Native women, 18 years and older, who had been teen mothers. And it was really great because I saw intergenerational themes that were happening. And a lot of the times, you know, there was the stories about, these women who had been younger, who some of them had gone to boarding school, some of them had gone to day schools, residential day schools, and they were able to share the chaos sometimes that their life, day-to-day life, they were experiencing. And that becoming a mother was often transforming. It was life-changing for them, that they felt, you know, and again, these are the women that stepped forward and wanted to be interviewed, that those women who are probably in a different place than women who, you know, did not step forward or could not step forward, but the women who stepped forward shared that becoming a mother was transformative, that even though it may have happened when they were 15 or 16 or younger, that it allowed them a moment to see where their life was going and how they wanted to change and what they could do to strengthen their mothering So one of the outcomes of this work was that the challenge that mothering doesn't start when you're pregnant or when you have a child, that it actually starts earlier. And that was what I found, that a lot of times these women at a young age, you know, age 8, age 9, were already making parenting decisions for themselves and their siblings. So they were already enacting like motherhood at a young age. And, you know, for some of them, it was keeping their siblings safe. Or for others, it was making sure that they had food and hiding food or hiding money so that they could have food, right? So there were these, you know, mothering kind of acts that were carried out. So it was the storytelling piece also for these women was very therapeutic. I can't imagine that me giving a survey and asking people just fill a bubble or fill in the blank would have allowed these women to really look at their life. And for the most part, many of them said, I've never said this before. I've never shared this with anyone. And it allowed them to look at their life experiences in a different lens and have me, even though I'm interviewing them, be with them through that experience and let them know that they're safe. They're good people, that they are never less than. And I think that that was very healing for them.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. That's so powerful. It reminds me of like this quote we were kind of passing around from one of Dan Wildcat's books about Western science being very much like there's one truth, you know, get all these numbers and find this one truth. But like from an Indigenous perspective, there's room for multiple truths. And like when you talk about storytelling in that way, that's what it reminds me of. And it also reminds me, I don't know if this is like a shameless plug, maybe not, because it's not usually my podcast, but like Mother Love. I mean, that's exactly what Claire does all the time, is give space for people in such like a loving way to share their truth and experience, and in a way to like help other people learn from their experiences. So it's just so powerful, this storytelling, how powerful it can be.
Thank you, Amy.
Yeah, it is. I have a business called Encoded for Story. And one of the activities I do is to help organizations, for example, people who review infant death. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to understand why particular infant deaths happen and what could be the prevention to prevent this, that I help them. I work with a cohort of people that are investigating infant death or maternal death. And the first thing that we do is I teach them how to tell their own story, because that is something in a Western model sometimes too, that, you know, I think about even physicians or in professional spaces, you don't tell your story. You are objective and you are held separately from your patient, right? Or you're held separately from the researcher to the investigator. There's this power dynamic. And I make it very clear that it is, in order to understand and better tell other people's stories, you know, that for change, for helping people improve infant outcomes or maternal outcomes, you have to know your own story first. Mm-hmm. And it's hard. It's hard to tell your own story. And it doesn't mean tell like the only story. It just, the idea is to find one part of your life, one event, one experience that you want to tell and that you can tell, mm-hmm. and tell it well, you know, with help, and get comfortable in that space, because you have to know how to do that and know the sacrifice and the tears and the joy that go into that crafting of a story before you touch someone else's story, before you work with someone else's story, before you help someone else craft their story, right? So telling stories, and many cultures do this, you know, many, many cultures tell stories. There's a time for storytelling or certain kinds of stories. And we as humans learn through storytelling. So yes, like through the Mother Love podcast, when people hear a story that resonates with them, they're going to remember that. And you know, they may not remember what you said or what you did, right? But they're going to remember that feeling. And that's, I'm paraphrasing from Maya Angelou, because like she talked about, like, it is the feeling that people remember.
It's true.
Yeah. So story work is sacred.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Agreed. I mean, I think we're built to learn from each other, right? We're built to, like, I heard someone say that, that learning, like, relationship is like the laboratory of learning, you know, where learning best happens when we're in relationship with other people and we're exchanging experiences in ways that when they resonate with us, it changes us in it, like, it's learning on a different level.
Mm-hmm. I love that stories are sacred, because they really are. And I think it's because of work from Indigenous scholars like you, who have kind of really fought to show how important that is and how valid and how useful, powerful that stories are, that it's more acceptable now. I think even the Western world, right? Like, now it's not just quantitative studies, which are numbers, but it's qualitative, where we are interviewing people and we are doing focus groups. And so when you say that stories are sacred, it's just like, makes me feel really grateful that, you know, for you, I mean, for the work that you've done, and just being able to like have that in your dissertation for, or in your papers for people like me who was doing dissertation work this past year, to be able to go to and cite or look to for that validation. So thank you from a self-identified data nerd.
Yeah, no, it's great to have partners in this work. And I have a great partner, Magda Peck, who was also with me on this national committee. And we've done some of the story work together. So it is to work with people who understand that storytelling is sacred, and the power of storytelling is also really important to continue this movement for storytelling.
Right. And your work is being recognized too. Like, you are an expert in the field and it's being recognized. And I, you know, you mentioned, we've been talking a little bit about this report, but just to kind of give our listeners a little bit idea of like your awesomeness, you were the first and only so far Indigenous person to serve on ACOM.
Mm-hmm. The Advisory Committee on Infant and Maternal Mortality.
Well, can you tell us about that, like that experience, mm-hmm. like how you got on there and some of the work that you did there?
Yeah, no, it's the story of how I got on there was you know, really fun. It was unexpected. I had been doing this work where I was trying to help people understand that to understand Native American maternal and infant outcomes and health, we have to combine history, historical trauma, and everyday lived experience weathering. And then I would give, because it was so abstract, I would give specific examples. So I would take out pieces from history, like in images, and talk about boarding school or talk about the Trail of Tears. And a lot of Native communities had been forced from their ancestral lands, and they all have their story about being forced from their traditional lands onto reservations. So the story of removal and loss of sacred sites, and just these different parts of the federal policies that have enacted on Native people. And when I was giving this presentation, you know, like 20 years ago, it was really interesting, because even Don Warren, who was a really well-respected Native American researcher in our country, I remember Don Warren was at one of these presentations, and I gave this presentation, and like everyone in the audience was stunned. Like, you could hear a pin drop, because it was so new, and I think hit so close to home for people that they just needed time to like really think about it and let it soak in. And now a lot of us are doing all this work, you know, like 20 years later, like it's old hat. Like, it's, you know, it's something that we all talk about. We all are understanding and all doing, but for the time it was new, and it caught the attention of someone who worked for the federal government. And she came up to me and asked if I'd be interested in serving on this committee. And I did not know anything about the committee, but I said, sure. And then The committee, though, it went through this period of where it had to be revived. And it took like 6 years before I heard anything about this committee. And when I finally did hear, you know, I submitted my CV, my curriculum vitae or my resume at the time, and I submitted, you know, information about myself. 6 years later, when I actually found out and heard back and I learned that the committee was coming together, I was asked to submit more personal information, and I was really worried that it was a scammer. And so I called to make sure that it really was the federal government asking for this information. And when I spoke to the lady on the phone, she said, yeah, this is actually real. And you're not the first person to call. We get a lot of phone calls asking if it's real. And so that was then another year later is when the actual committee was revived and started. So late 2018 or early 2019 was when the first committee meeting happened. And I had just had my son. I have three children and he was 3 months old. So I never got to meet anyone in person. All the meetings I ever did were all virtual, and then the COVID happened. And so then everyone was virtual. And it was just September of 2022 when I, at the end of my 4.5-year term, that I met everyone else on the committee for the first time in person. Oh, wow. So the last year and a half, we spent a lot of our attention on American Indian Alaskan Native maternal infant outcomes. We had spent previous to that a lot of time on Black maternal health, and we had experts that talked about all sorts of issues that affect maternal health in our country, like housing, secured housing, food security. We learned from environmental experts with climate change, what kind of changes we can expect in our health. We learned from rural health experts about maternity care deserts. And that's nothing new for Native people that live in rural areas. That is basically how we live. We live in these maternity care deserts where it's difficult to access prenatal care or delivery care for the childbirth process because we are so geographically isolated, or because of insurance access areas, or because we don't have reliable transportation. So we learned from a lot of different experts, and then we synthesized our findings and recommendations into reports. But the last year and a half of my service, we focused largely on American Indian Alaskan Native health. And I co-authored the first ever report on American Indian Alaskan Native maternal health in our country, and came up with over 50 recommendations. And we know that there are many more recommendations that need to be made, but these were the ones that we heard repeatedly throughout other invited experts and community people that were very important.
Wait. So this was the first ever report that focused on, and it was just last year? Like, that was the first ever?
The first ever to come out of this committee. Yes.
Wow. That's kind of sad. I can't, or, you know, yeah. Like, I'm glad that it did, but geez, I mean, that's crazy to me.
No. And people will ask, well, why? And this is why. Because Native people are not counted correctly, if we're counted at all. So anytime we look at national reports, and even if it's reported on the news, you know, like on a newspaper or news article or online on the web or on TV, Native American people, American Indian Alaskan Native people are always the asterisk. We are always this little note that says we have insufficient numbers and they cannot make statistical analysis of our numbers are not going to be meaningful. And that tells me that not all states are capturing our data. And then those that are trying to capture our data, still Native people are misclassified, highly misclassified. So because of our history, we are a very highly mixed group of people. And if you're going to count American Indians, Alaska Natives, you cannot count single race. You have to count multiple races, and you have to include Hispanic ethnicity because of our history of dispersion and because of our history of genocide and assimilation. Like, you have to have broader methods of identifying us in order to capture our numbers. So this is the first report because states and the federal government were just simply not counting us correctly. And to this day, we don't know the full depth of our maternal infant health issues. We say that, you know, on the U.S. average amongst Native American women, that Native pregnant people die, or maternal death rate is about 2.5 times the rate of white women in our country. But I would say that that is likely very low, that we are actually higher because we have to, we're not captured adequately. And there are just a few states where community members have stepped forward asking their own data to be reviewed. So for example, South Dakota, there was a South Dakota report on maternal, American Indian maternal death. And for South Dakota, the American Indian maternal death rate was 7 times the rate of white women, the national rate of white women.
Oh my God.
There's recent numbers that in the state of Washington, American Indian Alaska Native women die almost like 300. The rate of death is like 300 per 100,000 women. So it's even higher than 7 times the rate of white women. So there are going to be regional differences and community differences that we just don't even know because we're not even getting to the data correctly. We're not identifying the data, and there are obstacles to that.
Wow. Wow. That's just that unknown, right? That's just like, does not feel fair, and it makes me mad, but I'm also like just grateful that this report is there and that other work is happening. You know, I think like this was kind of a lot of my why too, when I was in school. And so it's just, I think it's just always like a harsh reminder of like sometimes how it is still. But I want to talk like a little bit more about the report because like I cited this report quite a bit throughout my dissertation, and I like to talk about it as far as your recommendations, especially with centering Indigenous communities and in leading the efforts of like establishing needs, but also solutions. And it was funny because when I knew you were going to be at the same meeting I was in Minneapolis, I was like trying to, on one hand, not be weird and awkward, but on the other hand, be brave. And like, I really wanted a picture with you because I cited you so much. And it was funny because I think that was like what I finally did was like, can I get a picture? I cited you. And like, just, I don't know, meeting somebody who you got to cite and you got to read their work. And I don't know, it was just, so thank you for not making me feel weird.
I could not tell. I mean, I think only just because you said that you were nerding out was the only reason or only way that I knew. But thank you. Thank you for sharing with me that this meant a lot to you, because in many areas, it's hard to tell where this report lands, right? Like, is it even being used? Is it even being listened to? Is it even being, is action being taken? You know, and to know that this spoke to you and the work that you are doing, Amy, is really heartwarming to me, because I know then that there's going to, work is going to continue, right? Like that this is, that Amy is going to continue doing this work as well.
Yeah, I hope so. Well, and then, okay. Also though, how did you get this information for the report? Like that was pretty novel too, right? Like,
yeah. You should see my computer. It is, I have so many articles, PubMed articles and reports that I looked and hand read. So I am largely responsible for all the background that helps people understand the context for this report. So, you know, the committee members and, well, the experts that came in, the community experts and the American Indian experts that came in, they really helped shape the recommendations. And so I, you know, was a part of that in terms of listening and writing them, but my bigger role definitely was crafting the background and the story. And that took a long time of gathering materials meticulously, and but also having this lived experience, because I think the chair of the committee said something, Dr. Ed Ellinger said something to the effect of, this report would not be what it is if we didn't have Janelle. And I agree that it is because of my lived experience and insight into the importance of history and ongoing experiences that I was able to help craft this story to better make the case of why we have the outcomes that we do and why we need these recommendations that we have to be implemented. And I framed it that way as much as I could with the evidence from these reports. So when I looked at these reports, it was really trying to craft that story. It was really trying to craft a perspective that would be grounding and help people who didn't have any prior knowledge or experience to really understand, like hold their hand and take them on this pilgrimage almost of understanding, so that they're not tourists, but that they see that they have a hand also in shaping this experience. And that was the intention of the report.
And it shares a lot of the history that you've already kind of talked about in more of an in-depth. So I'm sure we can link it in the show notes and get that information to people. And what about the testimony part of that? Like, what was so unique about the way they did it with Dr. Palacios, with the indigenous person on the committee? You know, how did it make it different?
So I will say that Magda Peck, who is also on the committee, she had a brilliant idea to invite people who were going to be at this three-day committee meeting. And these invited guests who were going to give testimony that be asked if they felt comfortable to share a personal story, to make it real for the state and federal partners who are also at this meeting to help them understand clearly. And many people, almost every person, started with a personal story. And that was so enriching because it took away this layer of like, here is a speaker, you know, whatever professional title they might have. But they were able to peel all of that professional off and just be seen as a human. And when they were seen as a human first, as a member of our nation, I believe that that allowed the audience, you know, we had federal partners in them, this audience, were able to then hear the rest of the story. And the story was the data that they gave or the experiences that they were encountering. And people who then shared stories and their quotes and gave their presentations, we asked them if we could quote them in the report. So then the report has this extra richness of quotes and stories that are told from these people, these amazing leaders and community members who shared their perspective and their story. And you get that, you get the richness of understanding, like, for example, Indian Health Service, that, you know, there's a long history of Indian Health Service and a lot of, it could be so much better, but that you get quotes from people who talk about the difficulty of integrating with Indian Health Service. You know, even as a midwife, if you're providing care to someone who wants to work with you, that if you want to order labs for someone, that you can't even access Indian Health Service. So how can you help this person who needs health care? Or, you know, just the quality of healthcare in certain facilities or the deterioration of the buildings, it's captured in these stories and in these quotes. And that adds another depth to it. And a federal partner who read this report shared with our chair, Dr. Ed Ellinger, that she was in tears reading this report. She was in tears reading the background and then having the lived stories right next to it.
It moved them. Well, it did. Where did this meeting take place?
Yeah. So for the first time ever, the committee left federal property and it happened on the Shakopee Midwaukon Sioux lands outside of Minneapolis, so on a reservation, on tribal land, on tribal property in a hotel. And it took a lot to advocate for that change. Dr. Ed Ellinger advocated probably close to a year to get HRSA, the Health and Research Services Administration, to realize that it's going to be so important to hold a meeting in the communities where these problems are happening. And after the Shakopee Mdewakan Sioux meeting was held, HRSA decided that every other meeting that was going to be held in person would be held in a community.
Wow. That is like some awesome change. Mm-hmm. So what now? I mean, like, what kind of action, hearing people being so moved and HRSA coming and hearing these testimonies and the report's been out for a while now, what kind of action has happened, or, you know, what kind of response from, you know, the people asking for this information, right? Like the federal government, like what have they done with the information?
Well, I would say that, you know, Secretary Becerra's response, who is the Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services, the response was very I don't even know if it was lukewarm. I mean, it not even tepid. You know, it was like there was nothing exciting about the response of this monumental report that was done and this monumental experience, like this human experience that happened. And he, by the way, he attended virtually for about 10 minutes maybe. So he was not there. And I think had he been present and experienced the ceremony of being in community with people, it would have possibly impacted him differently. He may have taken a more personal interest in the crafting of his response. The response we received was that HRSA was taking actions to address these recommendations. And then they gave a list of the recommendations that they were enacting. And some of the work had already been done, had been going on beforehand. So it wasn't anything spectacularly new or blowing our minds. Much more could be done. Much more. But I will say that we had partners from the CDC who were at some of our meetings. They were on, you know, online in the meetings with us, and then at Shakopee, they were at the Shakopee Mdewakan Sioux meeting. And I will say that it did change how they are going to address and look at identifying Native people. And they published a report where they looked at, if we're looking at maternal mortality, and we have these committees that not throughout the entire nation, but in most of the states have these committees that look at maternal mortality, like why a death happened around pregnancy or in pregnancy. And they try to determine like what were the causes, what were the factors involved in this person's death? Because we know that when she dies, the baby has problems of living, like the quality of life for that baby can be impacted and the family at large. So how can we prevent these deaths, right? So they found that they had been counting Native American people as a single race in these maternal mortality reviews. And for a time period, they saw that only 9 Native American women had been identified. And because of them listening to our testimony and listening to the need to include and broaden our definition of American Indian, Alaska Native identity in terms of counting us, they did that. And when they did that, they nearly doubled their sample. They nearly doubled the number of Native women found in maternal mortality reviews. It went from 9 to 17. So we know that the CDC did they did a great job of listening and then enacting. And so now we need to see more of those policies happening. The CDC also has been working with the National Indian Health Board on identifying what it would look like to have tribally led maternal mortality review committees. And this is very important because we know that on maternal mortality review committees, it's very important to have people from the community who are involved, who understand the community, to be involved in understanding someone's death. And having representation, having power, a dynamic of power where tribal communities or tribal people are involved is going to help shift how these deaths are reviewed, how these deaths are handled in terms of what can be learned or what can be prevented or what can be done in the community to promote health and well-being, right? So that is also a very powerful event that's taking place right now that I'm excited for. And we need more of these changes to happen. We definitely need more changes to happen.
How can people be a part of the change? Like, how can we help? How can we, you know, try to get people to read the report, or, you know, how do you see people helping in this kind of movement?
Yeah, I think it comes back to this understanding that, you know, we are all humans and that we all have common desires and needs, and we all have common human experiences, and we have to see each other as humans. We have to see each other as people who were born from women that have had parents and families that have siblings, that we have to see each other in this way. And sometimes to do that, you have to learn history. You have to learn why there are, you know, why we have reservations, or you have to learn why we have people coming to this country from Central and South America. You have to be aware of what's going on in other parts of the world to understand, like, the dispersion of people, I think. So you have to be able to be open to learning about other people, their histories, their cultures, in order to be in a community space with people. And I think that is probably one of the biggest things that we can do. Because once we do that, once we take action where we can be in community with one another, then women are valued. And I would say that in our country, women are not valued to an extent that, you know, Viagra is a covered benefit. Immediately when Viagra was invented and went to trial and was found to work, it immediately became a covered benefit. But sanitary napkins, tampons, I still have to buy those. You know, like, that tells me that something that is needed for females biologically, that we don't have equal access to that. We have differential access to that. It depends on your insurance. It depends on what schools you go to. It depends on what communities you're in. It depends on what states you live in, whether or not you have true free access to this. And that should be something that we should all have access to, because it is something for our health. Mm-hmm. So we often talk about in the maternal child world that the infant, the baby, is like the canary in the coal mine. That the infant is a very sensitive measure as to how well a country is doing. And we are doing abysmally. We are not doing great as a nation. And there was a report just released last week where we have a 3% infant death rate. Like, it's, our death rate amongst infants is not decreasing, it's increasing in our country for all babies. Not just one group, but for all babies. And certainly Black and Indigenous infants die at a higher rate than white infants, but all babies are dying at a higher rate. And that means to me that we need to start taking care of the women that are carrying, the pregnant people that are carrying these infants, and the families, in order to have better outcomes. And we're not doing that. You know, you're asking, what can we do? So it is advocating for being in partnership and community with one another. It's advocating for different choices and options for care, for prenatal care and delivery care, right? That we have to be able to have access. People simply need access to care while they're pregnant and postpartum, for sure. Yeah. And in rural communities like Montana, we know that, especially amongst Native women, the access and the use of prenatal care is really low. So, like, Native women, especially Native women living on a reservation, are like much higher rates of inadequate prenatal care access, like 45%. Will have a rate of inadequate prenatal care access versus white women in Montana, which no matter where they live, have about 13 to 14% of inadequate prenatal care access. We know that Native women are more likely to deliver at hospitals in Montana that don't have an OB or a midwife. That boggles my mind. Mm-hmm. We know that Native women in Montana also are more likely to deliver at a level one hospital, so they might have service or access to someone who can do the delivery. But that Native women travel much farther than white women to get to these hospitals.
Right.
Another solution is to have options for sure in care. So there are different avenues of birth workers that if we had, you know, doulas and we had midwives and nurse midwives or lay midwives, but just different practitioners that are related to birth, whether that lactation consultants or social workers or mental health postpartum mental health workers, that these people are going to be very important for access and improving the health in Montana. So Montana State University is in the actual process of trying to get their school of midwifery off the ground. And hopefully 2024, fall of 2024, there will be a cohort of midwives coming in. They're going through their accreditation process, but it is one solution to improving the maternity care deserts that Montana is currently experiencing, that women in Montana have very long drive times and miles that they have to come across in order to gain access to care.
Yeah. It's hard to sometimes talk about all the work that needs to be done, but then leave, you know, an episode, a listening experience and feel kind of this like hopelessness or, you know, and just feel like, oh no, like what now? And so it is always nice to highlight and be specific about the efforts that are being made. So thank you for sharing that piece. Yeah.
So much work to be done, but thankfully we have people like you leading the way and helping the ones coming next to learn and just trying to make it better. And just thank you so much for all the work you're doing, but for coming on today, being here on Mother Love and just sharing about the work. I mean, I think that's something me and Claire talked a lot about when thinking of who to interview for this series. Like, what kind of work do we want to share and highlight? And especially you being from Montana and the work that you've done, we're just so grateful that our listeners get to hear your story and hear more about the important work you're doing and, you know, how we can help too. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you. My pleasure being here.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Dr. Palacios. That was amazing. There's just like, there's so much wisdom. It's hard to even, I feel like I'll need a day to even think about everything that we touched on. And I just appreciate it so much.
Yeah.
Mother Love is hosted by Healthy Mothers, Healthy Babies, the Montana Coalition, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the health and well-being of families who are expecting or raising little ones. Opinions and views expressed in these interviews do not necessarily represent the views of HMHB as an organization. We sincerely value the lived experiences shared on Mother Love, and we understand that not everyone will agree with or relate to all of what is shared. Mother Love exists to help our guests and listeners honor and embrace their own stories and experiences. If the content in this episode has caused you concern or distress, please reach out to someone you trust for support. Speaking up about our struggles is half the battle, sometimes more than half, and there are many providers who can and want to help. Visit our statewide online resource guide at www.hmhb-lifts.org to help you find resources in your area.
Thank you to our incredible editor and producer, Brooke Boone Miller, for sharing her gifts with us. She's a mom and she gets it, and for that we are so grateful.